This is the voice of Carnage, and you are listening to Carnage Cast.
Hi everyone, welcome to episode 6 of Carnage Cast. This time out, Interview with the Gamer catches up with James Carpio, role-playing game designer and owner of Chapter 13 Press. We talk with him about his current and upcoming projects before turning to our autopsy of a game, in which Chuck, Rod, and Sarah talk about Sekigahara, a two-player war game from GMT Games, based on the 1600 Tokugawa campaign that unified Japan for over 200 years. And now, here's James Carpio.
Now, Interview with the Gamer.
Hi, I'm here at Carnage with James Carpio, sole proprietor of Chapter 13, publisher of many fine RPGs. How are you today, James?
Doing okay. It was a great time last night, so just a little bit of recovery this morning, trying to wake up.
You had a big game last night?
Yeah, actually I had two big games. I ran a kind of a closeout demo for my game Death Race Z, and it just went pretty wild, went the full rounds. And then last night I was actually doing a playtest for a game that I'm currently in development for Lamentations of the Flame Princess, based on the Roanoke Colony. And surprisingly enough, although I was kind of nervous about running it for the first time, it worked out really well.
Awesome. So you're working to publish Deathrae Z right now?
Yes. After some time in development and going to many cons trying to perfect it with my home group, we're finally getting to the final stage of getting artists hired and layout set up.
What's the high concept on that?
Well, I'm a big fan of 60s B-movies, Grindhouse, and Roger Corman stuff. So a while back, watching Death Race Z again with David Carradine and Sylvester Stallone, I just kind of, it dawned on me to go, wow, you know what would be really great is this movie with zombies. And then also taking a cue from some of the recent Rodriguez films like Machete and Death's, I can't think of the other one that he did with Bruce Willis, where it was a zombie film basically. But those sort of films kind of inspired me to go forward with the project, and it's been working out pretty well. Pretty cool.
Cool. Now, that's your current project, but more recently you did something a little unorthodox with Spooky Beans, right?
Yeah, Spooky Beans is kind of a weird thing. It started off as an idea on the Forge forums about 7 years ago, and that's where I've met the co-author and the artist for it, Ben Morgan. And it's just been a kind of a labor of love, just playing it, running at conventions, and finally this year we finally put it out on PDF through DriveThruRPG. It worked out really nice. We found a really cool cover artist, Nick Palazzo, at Kineticon, and a friend of mine from my San Francisco goth days, Serena Valentino, who writes Gloom Cookie, wrote the foreword for it, and we just recently got it out.
Cool. So, are there any other projects on the back burners you want to talk about?
One I'm very excited about. We had just signed a license with Goodman Games. As you know, Joe Goodman's putting out Dungeon Crawl Classics sometime in the spring next year. And so far, there's other third-party people doing adventures, but so far we're the only company that is going to be doing a full campaign setting for it, called Tales of the Fallen Empire. Kind of a Lovecraftian slash Robert E. Howard slash, Farford and the Grey Mouser sort of setting, with a little bit of weird kind of a Stargate-y Egyptian feel to it. So we're kind of very happy about that.
And if people want to learn more about any of your games, where should they go?
To our website, definitely, www.chapter13press.com. And from there, we have links to Spooky Beans, Pulp Era, which is an older project of ours that we're going to revise next year, and Tales of the Funk, which is our imprint for all our 70s Grindhouse games.
Thanks, James. Thanks for talking with us, and I hope you have a good rest of the weekend.
All right. Thank you for having us. Thank you.
Next, we take you to an autopsy of a game.
Hi,
Autopsy of a Game. My name's Tyler, and I'm here with
Rod,
Chuck,
and Sarah.
And today we're talking about Sekigahara, the unification of Japan. And this is a specialty of Chuck. So Chuck, why don't you give us a little overhead view of what the game's about?
Sekigahara is a new war game from GMT Games on the final 7-week campaign that brought the shogunate and the unification of Japan in around the year 1600. The stability and basically peaceful orientation of the country lasted for the next 250 years. And this is a fairly simple war game where you use blocks to represent your units and cards to decide how you move, how you fight combats and stuff like that.
Okay.
It's got a gorgeous board of most of the main island.
Right, you've got the board of the game spread out on the table here. And this is the whole main island of Japan, or most of it?
It's most of it.
Okay.
It's got Kyoto, is on one side, was the capital of the Ishida faction, who were basically the old guard who were being overthrown. And then there was Edo, which became modern-day Tokyo, which is a fairly small town, or just a small starting city at this point, which had just recently been founded. And that was the Tokugawa faction, who had basically the rebels who rose up, brought the next few centuries of peace to Japan.
Okay. So with two factions, it's a two-player game where one side is Ishida and the other side is
Tokugawa.
Tokugawa, okay. So it's really head-to-head action.
Very much. You basically will be moving your armies made up of the blocks that you have on the board. The blocks are basically variable strengths that you'll see by various Japanese symbols that represent the clans that fought for each side on the back of them. The blocks are a great little mechanic because your opponent only sees the solid-faced colored side and does not know what's on your side of the block. So it doesn't know what you're moving until you actually run into each other and fight a battle.
Right.
It's a fog of war situation where you don't know what you're running into. And even if you can try to keep track after you've seen them during combat, you still may not know what's there.
Oh, so even when you're in the battle, you don't know what the units are.
Correct. Unless they're, well, when we get to the battle, the combat phase, you'll find out that maybe not all those blocks will be committed to the battle.
Okay. All right, so how does the game kick off then?
The setup of the game is basically the units starting in their historical places. There's some randomness at the start. The game is basically 14 turns that represent two turns take place in each week.
So is that sorry to interrupt for a second. Yep. Is that each player gets a turn within a week, or is that each player is going to get 14 turns over the whole game?
Each player is going to get 14 turns over the course of the game.
Gotcha.
And this is an automatic victory earlier. Players use a card, and there's various numbers on the card that represent, and they each bid to see who's going to get the choice to determine who goes first in each week.
Okay.
So you'll be bidding on who goes first on the first two turns at the start of the game, and or second, because you can choose to go second if you want.
Right.
And then you basically will have your hand of five cards, and you will discard the number of cards you want, depending upon how far you want to move, or how many units you want to move. So if you want to move all your units, you'll use two of your cards out of your hand. If you want to just move one and have, what is it, one or two?
If you want, the limited move is one card, and that's you can move three stacks or muster with one of those moves. Zero cards is a minimal move, and a minimal move is one stack or a muster. Also, zero can be used if you don't want to do anything. It can be used to discard cards out of your hand and draw new cards.
Okay.
The cards are really nice. They're a good card stock to begin with.
Is that a linen finish?
It is.
Yeah, it's got a little cross-hatching in it.
What the cards have on them are clan symbols that represent each clan, as well as the numbers. In the initiative phase, the numbers are what we're looking at on the cards. In the movement phase, it doesn't matter what the cards are. They just get discarded.
Okay, so the cards have multiple functions.
Correct. Yep. And you'll find that later on, during combat, the clan symbols and the swords, which are special units, will come into play.
Okay. So you start off claiming cities on the board, or determining where your forces begin?
Yeah, and that's all preset, basically, on the board. There'll be certain units will go in, like in Edo, there'll be four Tokugawa units, and then two more random ones will start off there.
Basically, each of the clans has a city that they start in.
Right.
And they're either with the Tokugawa or the Ishida factions.
And the board itself has roads that connect various cities. It has some locations with castles. And some of the cities are basically red on the board, and those represent important centers or cities that will be victory points at the end of the game. And the castles, some start controlled, but which all start controlled by one side or the other, will also be worth victory points at the end of the game. And if you get all the way to the end of the game without a sudden death happening, you will just total up victory points at that point. A sudden death comes from either side killing its main leader or the other side, or there's an heir, or the regent, but he was a young boy, really, in Osaka, who starts in Osaka Castle, who was represents a previous leader of Japan, its son. You capture him, you also have won the game for the rebels, the Tokugawa.
So those are some of the automatic victories, losing either general, major general for either side, or if Tokugawa captures the heir, then the game is over immediately. Otherwise, it goes to the end, and it goes to a victory point count, taking the resource centers or the castles. The phases of the game go, you start with, like Chuck said, each player will play two turns. So in turn order, however the initiative turns out, a player will move, move all the stacks that he's done, whether he discards zero cards for a minimal move in one stack, or whether he discards two cards and moves all of his moves. He will move his troops and muster troops. The mustering phase is like reinforcements coming on. Reinforcements only come on at certain cities. The clans usually have to match. There is an exception to that rule where you can bring on one block of any force in any of the reinforcement cities. When you move, you have one basic movement point, and then you get additional movement points or subtract movement points for various situations. If you're moving along a highway, you get plus one. If there's a leader with the stack, you get another plus one. Or you can force march, which involves discarding another card to get a plus one movement. However, you do lose points for larger armies. Up to four blocks moves with no penalty. And then in multiples of four, you lose one movement point per multiple of four. So five to eight, you would lose one movement point. 9 to 12, you would lose 2, and so on, until you get down to 17 or above, and you can't move that stack. You can't move that many blocks. It's
right.
Just simply not possible.
The bigger the army, the harder it is to get everybody to
get
to
them
move.
To get them rolling.
Okay.
Correct.
So does that mean that the game rewards being light and mobile, or is it better to mass up forces?
Very much so. It's very much about mobility and confusing your opponent about where your best army is at. And it's kind of very Japanese in its play in that it's very subtle. And because the blocks are hidden, you are always trying to either confuse your opponent about where you are or put a feint out where he won't expect it and hit him where he's not expecting you, and just keep the gameplay fast and furious.
Okay. And you're trying to keep your opponent guessing as to exactly what you're doing and where you may be going. And what you have with you. The other thing is, as we get into, once you've moved, you go into combat. If you end up in the same spot with another army, you go into combat, and the beauty of the combat is, again, you have the fog of war. You don't know what's there.
Uh-huh.
The other part of that fog of war, it's almost like a double fog of war, is that you don't know what cards your opponent is holding, whether he can actually activate that full army.
Right.
Because when you get to combat, to activate the blocks, you must play cards that match the clan of the blocks that you're with to commit them to that combat. Like I said before, the cards have clan mons on them. And to activate a block, if I have the Ukita clan with me, if I'm the Ishida, and I have a block with them, I must have a card that matches that to commit a block to battle.
Okay.
When a block is committed to battle, they have a certain number of clan mons on them, and that's the strength of the block. So if I had an Okita card and I committed one block with three mons on it, that would be a 3 impact or a 3 strength committal.
Okay.
There's initiative in battle as well. It always starts with the attacker. Once the attacker is committed and has more impact in the battle than the defender, then the defender can respond. This will continue back and forth as each side one-ups, so to speak, each other in impact points. So if I were playing as the attacker and I had the Okita and I played an Okita three block, a card that activated that block, I would then have three impact against Chuck's Tokugawa.
Mm-hmm.
Chuck then needs to go to three or higher to go above my impact, which then sends the initiative back to me.
Right.
We continue doing this until we either pass, we choose not to commit more blocks, or we run out of cards that we can commit, that we can use to commit blocks, or just plain run out of cards.
Mm-hmm.
And then impact determines the winner. Most impact wins. If you are the loser, you will lose at least one block. For each seven impact that is inflicted on your side, you lose another block.
And that's important. That's full seven.
Right. Rounding down.
Okay.
The game, like I said, has a double fog of war in that you may know what's coming at you, but, you know, is it a feint? Do you want to fight? Because does the other player have enough cards in their hands to activate that army or enough of that army to win? There is one special card that can be played during this time. It's a loyalty challenge card.
Mm-hmm.
What the loyalty challenge card does is it's played by whoever does not have the initiative. If I commit a block and Chuck has a loyalty challenge card, he can challenge the loyalty of that troop.
Okay.
I must show another card from my hand that matches the mon or the clan of that the mon of that clan that I've just committed.
Right.
If I cannot, then that troop will switch sides.
Oh.
Right in the middle of battle.
And so its impact will be added onto the side that played the loyalty challenges card.
Right.
And any losses that are taken by the side that is on, that's the first loss taken. Yeah. So there are certainly some surprise aspects to this. So with the combat, in that you don't know what blocks are there, you don't know what cards are being played, and does that player have, and each deck has loyalty challenges in it. So you don't know whether they're holding that. In one of the games Chuck and I played, it came right down to the last play, and I happened to have a loyalty challenge that saved my general and allowed me to go on and win the game later on. So it's a kind of a unique combat system, one that I certainly haven't seen in any war game.
Oh, it's delightful. It's everything is kind of hidden and secret, but you have hints, and you know your memories of previous battles will have you an idea what's in each stack. If they fought with them before, but you won't know what's in the guy's hand, how effective it'll be today.
Mm-hmm.
It gives a very much a good feel for the period where you weren't always sure about the loyalty of everybody on your side. Because when it came down to the final battle at Sekigahara, there were basically one huge clan basically was tried to stay out of it on the side of Ishida. They started on the side of Ishida, and then Tokugawa thought he had these guys coming on his side, so he lopped a couple of shots at them, and they finally came in on, turned traitor against Ishida, and came in on his side. So in the game, that'd be, you know, exactly shown by using the loyalty cards, and all of a sudden you have a big part of your force turns traitor.
And it changes the aspect of the combat. Changes the whole combat. Now, of course, you're running through cards while you're playing combat. So the last phase of your turn is the card replenishment phase, where you replenish every card that you played. You'll get a new card after each combat. So you're not limited by, if you start two combats in a turn, you'll do one first and then you will replenish. So again, there's a random factor there is, you know, maybe you were planning on having certain cards that you don't now have. You had to use them in a different way.
Right.
So you replenish for each card that you use during combat, and for each two blocks you lose in the combat, you get an additional card. So it kind of is a balancing act there, a balancer for the loser, so that they have additional cards for another combat.
Right, and because they have fewer forces on the board, suddenly it's easier to coordinate their actions.
It can be, but it also could be, I'll refer back to a game that Chuck and I played not too long ago, where I had one clan practically wiped out in some early battles. Unfortunately, their clan cards came up late in the game for me, so I was tossing them to movement and to initiative rather than using them in combat because I did not have that clan on the board.
Right.
It was kind of frustrating, and it hampered me. It hampered me against Kyoto and Osaka. One other type of combat also is siege combat. Siege combat is basically Chuck described the castles on the board. If you have two or fewer units at a castle, they can go inside the castle, and then the castle is laid siege to.
Mm-hmm.
There is no defensive cards played, no defensive units committed in a bat in a siege battle. The offense commits their blocks, and for every 7 that they get, they destroy one block within the castle. If they can destroy all the blocks in the castle, they'll take the castle. Siege combat is very simple. Again, card replenishment. They'll replenish each card they use. The defender of the castle will get an additional card for each block they've lost, so up to 2 cards.
Because mm-hmm.
there can only be 2 blocks inside of any castle.
What distinguishes a castle on this board?
They are kind of like the Padoga
icons
on the board.
So there's a limited number of castles on
the board. And the color around the castle shows you who starts in control of that castle. If the castle's left unguarded after it's taken, it will revert back to the original owner. In other words, the peasants of the area or the locals will go back to taking the castle if it's not kept by the other side.
Yeah, back to the traditional loyalties.
Right.
Okay. So over the course of the 14 turns, people are wresting control of these cities and castles back and forth. And if you haven't hit a sudden death condition, you get to the end and tally up your victory points, which came from
the resource centers, which are the red cities,
right?
The major red cities and the castles. The red cities are worth 1 victory point. The castles are worth 2.
Okay, so it's there is a limited number of these places on the board. So that's really where a lot of the action is going to be, is getting hold of those.
Well, it's very interesting, and I found playing it that over near the capital, Kyoto. There's a lot of highway and a much quicker movement.
Mm-hmm.
And there is less movement on the farther side, the eastern side of the board of the island. So getting troops out there is tougher. And that's where Takagawa starts a lot of their troops.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the rebels come from. The two theaters, or the two areas that a lot of the battles are fought very differently. A lot of quick strikes on the capital side, on Kyoto side. And more a slogged down, slower battle on the eastern side.
Right, because you have to go the long way around to get to a wall.
Correct. And you'll notice there are 2 types of roads. Well, I said that, you know, highways give you +1 movement. Well, there are secondary roads as well, which give you no additional movement. So to get through them, you're going to have to force march or have a leader with you to get through them rather quickly.
Yep.
So the strategies are varied depending on what part of the board you're fighting on and what side you're fighting on.
And which cards and all you have in your hand. So you'll know which armies and which groups of blocks that you are willing to commit to a battle.
Correct. So the sides aren't precisely the same or even.
Oh, absolutely not.
Is the construction of their decks different as well?
They are. The Tokugawa basically have higher initiative for bidding on. And they have, I think... maybe one more loyalty card.
One or 2 extra challenge. Loyalty cards.
So they're basically designed to be a little bit more mobile and more aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
But both sides have to be mobile and aggressive in the game. The Ishida, the loyalists, can bring on more troops and stuff over the long course of the game. But it's much more questionable if they'll have the resources to do it.
Mm-hmm.
The Ishida has special units to come on. They start in reinforcement, and they're the Mori. And when they bring them on, so they can certainly bring on more troops, and these are more powerful troops than some of the other troops that are on the board. The Tokugawa have the Red Devils, which are 1 block, and it's the only block in the game that has a 4 mon on it, so it's a 4 strength unit.
Okay.
And they can be activated by any card.
All right.
So there are certain differences to the sides. And certain strengths and weaknesses that they have.
Do all these even out in the end, or is it there's?
They do. They do. Like any war game, that's asymmetrical. They do balance each other out. It's just different strategies that you need to use.
Right. You have to know what your side's strengths are, and then
correct
follow them.
And it's not horribly asymmetrical. The position is a little bit different, and the Tokugawa is probably a little more centralized along the main highways with most of their forces. But by the time you get to mid-game, the position should have pretty much, at that point, be figured out.
Right.
And you start coming down to how to manipulate your opponent probably into making a mistake so you can jump on them.
Right. Or cornering them or catching them without the correct cards or catching them with the wrong blocks or
right. So
the wrong armies.
one thing you want to do is try and get your opponent to burn their cards where it's not as helpful.
Correct. Absolutely.
I mean, it really is one of the most delightful games I've played. It. There's some other block games out there. Columbia's known for making them. GMT's published a few other ones lately. Probably the most popular one lately has been Hammer of the Scots, about the English invasions of Scotland. It's around, what, 1350 or 1400, something like that,
mm-hmm.
Which is a very accessible game as well. But this one, it's a prettier game. The rules are basically really simple and really accessible. I could basically sit down and play this with almost anybody.
Absolutely. It's a high production quality. And like Chuck said, the rules are maybe 8 pages long, the actual rules. And they're very simple. Great introductory game for anyone that wants to learn basic war games.
So for anyone, so it's a great jumping in point for the genre of war games, isn't
it? Yeah, it's not as complicated as some of the other war games that are out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think playtime, I mean, basically, you know, 2 hours is more than doable in this game.
Yeah.
And with good players who played it multiple times, I could see it getting well under that,
mm-hmm.
which is important, especially if you're using it as an introductory. I mean, this is one of the most impressive games, and it lingered on GMT's, who has this pre-buy list, the P500, and it kind of languished on the there for a number of years before it got published. And it was under my radar, and I just recently picked it up, and I was like, I was really surprised just how good a game it is.
And since publishing, it's been a very popular game, from hardcore war gamers to the novice war gamer that wants to just sit down and learn how to play some of these war games.
Mm-hmm. In addition to novice war gamers, who would you say this game is going to appeal to most in the gaming population?
Well, it's, I think it has appeal to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's, you know, people are talking about it on Board Game Geek, but also hardcore war gamers I know have sat down and have played it over and over and over again, because it plays quickly. It's so enjoyable.
Yep.
You've got a tense situation on the board, which keeps you focused on it and, you know, watching what you're doing and watching what your opponent's doing and trying to figure out what his plan is. And
mm-hmm. So there's no way, there's not a lot of dullness happening where people
want
it up at opposite ends of the board.
Very little downtime at all. You're always thinking about your next move. You're always worried about what your opponent is bringing to the table or bringing to an area where you control. It's a really fantastic game, and I think it would appeal to just about any gamer. I've heard people that I consider Euro gamers, people that I would consider more war gamers, both really want to try this game, you know, and people like myself that play a little bit of both really like it as well. It's a fantastic game, dynamic game. Can hardly wait to get it back on the table and play it again. Sarah, do you want to try it?
Yes.
That is Sarah's verdict. So, it's published by GMT. You can find it anywhere GMT games are sold. Sounds like it's a good buy for the price, is what I'm hearing.
What does it cost?
It's about a $60 game. But you get like 96 of these great blocks, these yep. wooden blocks.
Feel like quality pieces. You know, you get a satisfying sense of shoving them around the board.
Mm-hmm. Right. You get the two decks. There are some cloth bags that are used for reinforcements. Because again, we didn't touch on this during the game, but the reinforcements are drawn randomly out of bags. So you don't know. That's another random factor in the game. And the board is a mounted board from GMT. A really nice. Nice looking board. The art is nice. All around a really good game.
Yeah, it looks great. All right, well, that's been Sekigahara, the Unification of Japan on Autopsy of the Game. Sarah, Chuck, Rod, thanks for commenting on it.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Carnage Cast, a production of NNEG LLC. All rights reserved. For more information, visit us at www.carnagecon.com.
There's a tentacle thing coming up behind her that's definitely not a ghost.